All right, Acts chapter 26. When we ended last week, Paul was in the middle of giving his address. It is his final address in the book of Acts. It's also his longest address in the book of Acts. He's talking to Festus. He's talking to Festus is the Roman procurator for this area. He's also talking to Agrippa and Bernice. They were had some Jewish ties, but they were also political figures in this region. And then, of course, there were their friends, a group of friends who showed up to hear what Paul had to say. Paul is still in Caesarea. By the end of this book, by the end of the book of Acts, he will be in Rome. And we've only got two more chapters, so it's going to be a quick trip that Paul will make. I've got a couple of pictures that I want to show you to give you some sense of where Paul is and what he's going through. Jessica, can you throw those up? What you see here is the area that's called Caesarea. This is where Paul was staying. It was the Roman capital of this region during the first century. This area right here at the bottom, I've got another picture that's coming up next, if you can go ahead and get that up. That is the amphitheater where we believe Paul spoke. The seats, I forget the number, several thousand people. I've been there, but you can stand here, and when you're seated up in the seats up here, you can hear people talking just at a normal voice. The acoustics are just phenomenal. But we believe that this is where Paul actually addressed the people, where he was addressing Felix. These stands would have been filled with people. The Romans were there. The Roman military was there. So it was quite the event. Paul, he knew that he was on his way to Rome. He never imagined, though, what would get him there. He never imagined the events that will take place in chapter 27. You know, most of us know his stories about the shipwreck and the snake bite and all of that, but Paul had no idea what was coming. This was all, you know, it was all being lived by him as he went forward day by day. He, like all of us, when we travel, expected, I'm sure, an easy voyage, you know, just a sail from where he was in Caesarea to Rome. He didn't expect all that was going to happen. Didn't expect a hurricane and a shipwreck and a snake bite and all of that. You know, if God tells me that I'm going to Rome, I'm expecting, you know, a first-class ticket on Lufthansa or the Queen Mary, but not the Titanic. Well, Paul got the Titanic on this particular trip. We'll pick it up in verse 24. It says, as he was making his defense this way, and this is Paul gets to the end of defending himself, really what he's doing is giving his testimony. When he gets to the end, Festus exclaimed in a loud voice, "You're out of your mind, Paul. Too much study is driving you mad." So at this point, Festus kind of loses it. He says, "Paul, you're crazy." Really, I think what he's saying, though, is that, "Paul, you're making me crazy with all of this stuff that you're saying." There was such conviction, I believe, on the part of Festus, on the part of Agrippa, and the part of Bernice, that it was palpable. It was a pressure that they were feeling, and Festus just goes off here. He interrupts Paul. And, you know, you got to kind of feel sorry for Paul because he never, it seems, never got to finish any of his sermons. He's always getting interrupted by riots or by beatings or by imprisonment or something. You know, I think he would have been happy if all he had to deal with were cell phones going off in the service. But parents, I want you to pay attention to this. I want you to beware of this because your teenagers may grab this verse and take it out of context. You know, they may come to you and say, "Hey, man, the Bible says too much study makes you mad. So, you know, I can't do any more homework." You know, context is king. You gotta watch this. It's out of context to take that from this passage. Verse 25. It says, "But Paul replied, I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus. On the contrary, I am speaking words of truth and of good judgment. For the king knows about these matters. It is to him I am actually speaking boldly. See, Paul is speaking to Agrippa here, this man who is part Jewish. For I am convinced that none of these things escapes his notice, since this wasn't done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you believe. Boy, Paul is respectful in the way that he talks to these leaders. He tries to correct the record here. He's telling Festus, no, actually, I'm not crazy. What I'm telling you is the truth. I'm telling you things of good judgment. But he also completely turns the tables here. Did you notice that? See, Paul has been the one who has been trying to defend himself by talking about the things that he did and the way that he was raised and why he went about doing the things that he did. But now he's turned the tables. Now it's Agrippa that's on trial. I imagine Agrippa is sitting there starting to squirm a bit. Paul is asking him, do you believe? And then he says, I know you do. Agrippa, I know you believe this. You've heard all of this stuff from a child. You know about the Messiah. You know he was supposed to come. You know about Jesus. You know what took place there. I know you believe. He's really pushing his case forward here. Now, verse 28 is it's a little difficult to translate. All the major translations have a slightly different inference or nuance to this particular verse. The Holman standard uses the word easy, verse 28, when it says, then Agrippa said to Paul, do you think that you're going to so easily convert me to Christianity? The New American Standard uses the phrase short time. Agrippa saying, Paul, do you think that in such a short time you're going to cause me to come to faith in Christ? The New King James has a different, it uses the word almost, and I'm going to actually use the New King James in verse 28 and 29 here, so I'm shifting translations for those of you who follow this. Verse 28 says, then Agrippa said to Paul, you almost persuade me to become a Christian. And Paul said, I would to God that not only you, but all also who hear me today might become both almost and altogether such as I am, except for these chains. Agrippa says to Paul, man, you almost had me. You almost had me convinced, Paul. Boy, I was close. I was almost there, but not quite. And Paul says to him, man, I wish Agrippa, not just you, but everybody here would be a little bit closer, but also all together, just as I am, except for these chains. Maybe interjecting a little bit of humor there. You know, I mean, he's in chains and they're all free, and he says, I want you to be just like me, and then he looks at the chains and goes, well, except for these things. You know, I don't want you to have to wear the chains. But even if he's joking, guys, there is an element of truth to what he says here. Because he's standing there in chains, but really he is the only one in this group that's free. He has these chains on him, but he's free. The people who were in the crowd, the people who were listening to Paul, they were free to get up and walk around. They were free to get up and leave if they wanted. But they were all in bondage to their sin. And so he speaks from a different kind of freedom. He says, I wish that you were like me, only not with chains, not with chains like these. Guys, everybody who doesn't know Jesus, if you don't know Jesus today, you are in bondage. If you don't know Christ, you're in chains. You are a slave to your own sin. That's what the Bible says. And Jesus is the one that wants to set us free. He has the ability to set you free. If you want real freedom, We're here to talk with you after the service today, to pray with you and to walk you through that process of coming into true, real freedom. Well, verse 30 says, so the king, the governor, Bernice, and those sitting with them got up. And when the king got up, that meant the meeting's over. And when they had left, they talked with each other and said, this man is doing nothing that deserves death or chains. And then Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been released if he hadn't appealed to Caesar. Agrippa is saying here, when he gets up, he says, I've had enough. You know, the conviction of God's Spirit is so heavy on him, he doesn't want to hear anymore. You may have talked with people in the past and shared Christ with them or shared your testimony with them, and at times they will say, you know what, I don't want to hear anymore. Because the conviction of God's Spirit is so powerful on them, and they're fighting back so hard, pushing back so hard, they just can't take it anymore. They don't want to hear anymore. And that's where Agrippa is here. He doesn't want to hear anymore about this. Festus, he's still got a problem. He has nothing to say to Nero about Paul, about the why he is sending Paul back to him. So he's going to have to come up with something. Festus only lives about 2 more years after this. He dies very suddenly. Some people think that he was a younger man, and so it was an unusual death. But he's under great political pressure in his position because there is such tension in this area, and he's trying to make everybody be nice and play nice and get together, but they just refuse to. But he's also under a great conviction of God's Spirit. And so he only lives about 2 more years. Bernice, well, she eventually leaves Agrippa. She goes from Agrippa to another guy, and she's kind of got, you know, this circle of men that she goes to. She eventually has an affair, a long-term affair, with Titus Vespasian, the guy who will destroy the city of Jerusalem and eventually become Caesar. But when Titus takes Bernice back to Rome with him, she's not accepted. And the powers that be in Rome, because she's not Roman, she's got Jewish blood in her, and none of those things were working in her favor. And so she was sent back to Jerusalem. And at that point, she disappears from the historical record. So we don't know what happened to her. They say that she was still beautiful late into her 40s, which was unusual in this day. This life was harder and people aged faster. You know, today with the paint and dyes and Botox, you know, you can fool people for a long time today. But back then, you know, people aged more quickly. Bernice, she went from man to man to man looking for something to satisfy her but never finding it. We see that today when people fall into adultery. That they're always looking for something better. This idea of that the grass is always greener on the other side. Well, let me tell you, the grass is always greener where you water it. Where are you spending time watering your grass? That's where it's going to be greener. Or as somebody said, that sometimes the grass looks greener on the other side because it's astroturf. It's not real, it's fake. Well, chapter 27, we want to get into this, is where they begin their trek to Rome. Verse 1, it says, when it was decided that we were to sail to Italy, they handed over Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Imperial Regiment. So they set sail for Rome. It's about August when they leave. That's late in the travel season. Because September was generally the last month that anybody would leave to go anywhere by boat. They're going to arrive in Rome in March. So it's about 7 months that they're at sea on this trip. Julius, it seems from, and we'll see more of him in this story as we go in the coming weeks, but it seems that he was a man of good character. In fact, all of the centurions that we meet in the New Testament are men of impeccable character. He's a centurion. He was over 100 men. He's a part of what's called the Imperial Regiment. This was a very high-level group of men. They were assigned to Caesar and to protect him. But this guy, boy, he has no idea what he's in for. He is going to a new assignment. And you know, you never really know what you're getting into when you go to a new assignment. It's always something different. New assignments have their challenges, and boy, this one is going to be a doozy for Julius. And notice also that Paul is not the only prisoner. He's not the only one going in chains to Rome. There were other prisoners on this voyage, and they were more than likely, none of these guys are going to stand before Caesar. These guys are going to die in the arenas. That's what Rome did. They took their prisoners of war and criminals, and they brought them all to Rome to torture them in the arenas. They would be eaten and torn apart by wild animals or tortured in some other ways. I mean, you've seen the movies, so you know what I'm talking about. The cry in Rome at this time was, give us bread and give us the games. That's what they wanted, food for their belly and entertainment. It may still be the cry in Rome today. I don't know. You know the Italians. It's. Give us espresso and give us the games. It's soccer these days. It's not, you know, not the kind of games they did back in Rome. But it's interesting that the word muse, it means to think about things. And in the Greek language, when you put the letter A in front of a word, it would negate it. And so to muse means to think. To amuse means to not to think. We've got an industry today that is built on making you not think. It's a global industry. Now, we pay people who, in many cases, are below average intelligence, but who are very entertaining, to help us not to think. I mean, that doesn't make us very smart, does it? You know, these men who are accompanying Paul, I just imagine that many of them on the voyage come to faith in Christ. Because of the difficulty and because of the challenges that they're going to face and because of Paul's testimony, because of the way that he lived, it's my belief that many of these men come to faith. All right, verse 2. Can we bring up the map? There we go. He's already ahead of me. Wow, look at you. Okay, so they are in Caesarea. You saw the pictures a minute ago. That's over here. They're going to follow this line. We won't get all the way to Rome today, but we'll get a ways on the trip. Verse 2, it says, so when we had boarded a ship of, and I'm going to butcher some of these names, so you'll bear with me, Adramyttium, we put to sea, intending to sail to ports along the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. And the next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and allowed him to go to his friends to receive their care. So their first stop is in Sidon. They don't get too far. They just get right up the coast here, and they pull in at Sidon and spend the night there. We see in this passage that the personal pronoun we is used. Luke writing this. Luke is with Paul on this voyage. And there's also this other guy by the name of Aristarchus who is with them as they travel. They put in at Sidon. And there are believers there. And this centurion, Julius, is kind enough to let Paul off the ship to go visit his friends. This is incredibly unusual. You see, Julius was responsible for Paul. If Paul had escaped, if he had gone to visit his friends and just not come back, Julius would be, his life would be on the line. And so this says to me that this guy Julius had a great deal of respect and admiration for Paul and trusted him, trusted that he would, you know, go see his friends and then come back to the ship. Paul knew, of course, that he was headed to Rome, and so he would go back to the ship. Verse 4, it says, when we had put out to sea from there, we sailed along the northern coast of Cyprus because the winds were against us. So again, this time of year is not the best time of year to travel. And after sailing through the open sea off Pamphylia, we reached Myra in Lycia. And there the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. So they go from Sidon up here. They've gone up along the coast. They went along the northern coast of Cyprus. And then they've made their way to Myra, where they put in. And he finds a larger ship for them, a different ship. He probably gets on this other ship because he wants to get to Rome as soon as possible. He's not in any... I didn't want to drag this out any longer than he has to. And so I imagine that he's looking for a ship that's going directly to Rome, a ship that will get there safely and as quickly as possible. And so he puts them on this grain ship. An Alexandrian ship is known to historians today. It was one of the largest ships that were made back during the first century, the first part of the Roman Empire. It had three masts. It was about 180 feet long, which is longer than this building. It would go from the back end of the cafe out past where the basketball court is on the back side of the building. That's the length of the ship. And the width of the ship would have been about where this music stand is to that wall over there. And it was taller than this building. So for that day, this was a very large ship. It would carry about 278 people in addition to all of the cargo that they would put on these ships. So it seems like it's a safe ship to be on. It's going directly to Rome, or so they thought. And so Julius puts everybody on this ship to take them to Rome. Verse 7, it says, sailing slowly for many days, we came with difficulty, again, the weather is not good, as far as Cundus. And since the wind didn't allow us to approach, we sailed along the south side of Crete off Salome. And with yet more difficulty, we sailed along the coast and came to a place called Fair Havens, near the city of Lycia. And by now... much time had passed, and the voyage was already dangerous, since the fast was over. Paul gave his advice and told them, "Men, I can see that this voyage is headed toward damage and heavy loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." So the trip is going slow. It's a difficult ship. Again, this time of year is a bad time to travel. And so they pull into this port called Fair Havens. It's down by Crete. They've come along the coastline, come down along the southern coast of Crete, and Fair Havens is right about there. And they pull in for take repairs, I'm not sure what else. The fast that Paul talks about here is more than likely the Feast of Atonement. So we are into October by this time. It's been a couple of months. Been a couple of months at sea, and it's been, you know, just slow traveling. You know, the winds have been heavy, the seas have been heavy, they've been, you know, up and down and up and down. Anybody get seasick here? Up and down. I'm sorry. Bad trip, though. If you have difficulty sailing, you know what that's like. The sea travel in the first century generally took place during April and through September. October, once you got into October, it was pretty risky. You had to have some serious deadlines or really need to get to someplace urgently in order to travel in October. By the time you got to November through March, nobody traveled. just because the storms that came up were so deadly and so fierce that nobody dared to travel during that time. People would just put into port and they would wait for spring to come. But the ship captain and the crew, they start to talk. And they say, you know what? We're not so happy about staying here in Fair Havens. And they want to push on. They want to try to make more headway. And Paul says to them, guys, you need to rethink this. Now, you need to know that in 2 Corinthians, Paul tells us that he had been in three different shipwrecks and at one point spent a night and day in the deep, floating in the ocean. That letter has already been written. So Paul has already been through three shipwrecks. And he's now on this ship, and they're headed out to sea, and he doesn't have a good sense about this. Paul's a little oversensitive about, you know, getting into another shipwreck. And so he's saying, guys, really, we shouldn't do this. This is not going to be good. But they're not going to listen. They're not going to listen to what he has to say. Look at verse 11. But the centurion paid attention to the captain and the owner of the ship rather than to what Paul said. And since the harbor was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided to set sail from there, hoping somehow to reach Phoenix, a harbor on Crete open to the southwest and northwest to winter there. So they're hoping to get to the west end of Crete, someplace on this side over here, and pull into a port called Phoenix, probably a nicer place, and spend their winter there. I'm guessing that Fair Haven just wasn't exactly a fair haven. You know, it's always a dead giveaway when cities and places have names like this. Greenland. There's nothing green in Greenland. It's rock and ice and miserable. Nobody would want to go. They named it that so that hoping to attract people to come. Iceland, a different place. It's much nicer. They named it Iceland because it was nice and they didn't want people to come. So you can't always go by the names that places have. Fairhaven, be honest, probably a dump. And they thought they would probably die of boredom if they spent the winter there. So they're ready to move on. This was no fun for sailors in Fairhaven. And trust me, this is the way sailors think. This, they always have, they always will. It's all about liberty ports, you know. So they decide to leave Fair Haven. They take a vote, and everybody wants to go, and so they weigh anchor, and they move on. Verse 13 and verse 14. It says, when a gentle south wind sprang up, they thought they had achieved their purpose. And they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. But, verse 14, not long afterward, a fierce wind called a nor'easter or a Euroclydon rushed down from the island. You know, guys, when you make decisions based on worldly input or worldly reasoning, a gentle south wind is always going to pop up. There's always going to be something there that will tell you, yeah, it's okay. You can go with this. You can listen to what these people are telling you. The gentle south wind will always pop up when you're getting worldly advice. But the problem is that verse 14 always follows verse 13. You can write that down. You get a warm wind, warm breeze, and man, it feels good. It feels nice. Everything feels wonderful. But then the hurricane hits. This storm is going to drive them over 500 miles. They're going to completely pull the sails down because they have no control over the ship. It's just going to blow them for 500 miles. You know, one writer said that all Christians are in one of three conditions. We are either headed into a storm, we are in the midst of a storm, or we are headed out of a storm. I know that really encourages you today. But I think there's a lot of truth to that. As the Christian life is a life of storms. We're going to get some great lessons through this chapter, through these stories from the storm that Paul went through. There's some great lessons here. One of the first lessons for us is getting into the storm. You know, nobody wants to go through a storm, but some storms are just programmed for us. They're set up for us by God. But sometimes we get ourselves into storms. Some of the things that get us into storms are being impatient. You know, God has us in fair haven. It may not be the most exciting place in the world, but God has us someplace. But we get impatient. We want to move on. We want to move to the next place. And so we take worldly advice and we move on. We move out. Another is to take worldly advice over God's instruction. God is very clear in His Word about how we are to live our lives and the things that we are to do and the things that we're to avoid. But sometimes, you know, the south wind blows and things seem okay, and well, it'll be okay this time. It'll be okay. I know most people are not supposed to do this, but you know, I'm the exception. God will make an exception for me. Taking worldly advice over God's instruction. The other is to go with the majority. Go with majority rule. You know, what does everybody think? Group think. You know, guys, democracy doesn't always give us the right answers. Sometimes it fails. So the crowd source is not always the best. That's how you get into a storm. So if you're in fair haven today, stay put. Yeah, it may not be the most exciting place in the world. But let me tell you, if you set sail from where God has you, the excitement that you're going to find may not be what you want. But we're going to end there today. We'll have Lacey and the worship team, want you guys come up and close us today. But there's some great lessons in this story of Paul going through this storm. And we'll look at the lessons as we look at these passages in coming weeks. The story begins with how do we avoid the storms of life? But what about if you're already in one? What if you're in a storm today? Well, we're going to look at that next week. So I encourage you to read ahead and come back. But there are lessons for us on how to survive storms, how to get through storms, how to come through storms. So I hope you'll read ahead and I hope you'll join us.